All right, I'm ready to move on. Was there any other questions on the Open Public Meetings Act? If not, I can move on to public records.
I just had one comment. You know, we are trying to find ways to bring this new board up to speed and communicate what's going on a monthly basis to each other. And we had started this idea of sending out a Friday email to everyone that would come from Superintendent Hutchins with input from Chief Putzing that would then go to all of the commissioners. And it would give the commissioners also an opportunity to say, hey, do you have anything you want to share? Did you go to a committee meeting this week? And was there something you wanted to share with the group? And then you could send that information to our superintendent, and then she could disseminate that information to all of us in her weekly Friday. We're calling it like a Friday update. Obviously, we're being really mindful about sensitive information because we are putting it in an email, and we wouldn't want a public records request or something like that. But it is useful in terms of having us all understand what the monthly workings are of our district. In any way, do you see that could be violating the OPMA?
No, okay. I think that's entirely, that's a great idea, and I've not heard of another district doing that, but that's great, and because there's no discussion going on.
Right.
It's just an informational piece of correspondence that's going out to each of the commissioners to kind of prepare you for the upcoming meeting in a way and let you know what's going on at the district. I think that's excellent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
And
all right,
Richard.
Yeah. Yeah.
The passive receipt of information is acceptable, correct? I mean,
that's correct.
We try to avoid having commissioners email each other, but they can as long as no one replies, right? I mean,
as long as no one replies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just don't email.
And we put that caveat on all emails. Never mind. I'm being facetious. I'm sorry.
All right, so I'm going to move on then to Public Records Act, and so here's the thing from a lawyer's standpoint: is we see very few OPMA violations that are litigated. That's just the reality. But we see almost every month we get a little book that comes around, and it's all of the cases that have been decided by our courts of appeal and the Supreme Court, and it's the exception, not the rule, that we don't see a public records case these days. So what's going on is you've got a cadre of attorneys that are specialists in this area. They represent plaintiffs. And then you've got a few plaintiffs. Arthur West is a good example. If you just Google his name, you will see that he has a ton of public records lawsuits against all kinds of different agencies in the state. Freedom Foundation. There's a bunch of these agencies or outfits now that are filing these kinds of claims. So we see a lot of these cases. And there's a few things to know. Most claims that are brought by these plaintiffs are successful because they managed to get the agency to trip up somehow. And it's easy to do. There are a lot of requirements. Secondly, these claims are not insured, as I mentioned before. I've only seen it in two cases. One case, I represented the city, and we got insurance because the plaintiff had said public records violation and you were negligent in not providing the records. Had they not said negligent, we wouldn't have had coverage. But because they used that term, we were able to get coverage. Almost never is going to happen again. Third thing to realize is these lawsuits are extremely expensive if you screw up. A plaintiff can get up to $100 a day per record that is withheld. Right? So that's, a record is a document. And that amount can add up quickly. And then finally, they get their attorney's fees and costs if they're successful. So, and that's through every level of litigation. At the trial court where it's litigated, and if it's appealed up to the Court of Appeals and then to the Supreme Court, those attorney's fees just keep adding on. And what I'm seeing these days is that plaintiff's attorneys are able to go out and get these attorneys to represent them on a contingency fee basis because there's so much money at stake in these kinds of claims. It's worth it for a lawyer to say, hey, I'll take a flyer on this and take a third of whatever is recovered because I know that the agency's good for the money. So, you know, it's like having insurance. So anyhow, that's the point. That's enough of the kind of scare tactics here. But these cases are common. So we're talking about, what is a public record? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Maybe that was what I was just going to ask. What's a public records violation? I mean,
he wanted to worry us enough so we remember the answer.
Just trying to grab your attention first, and then we'll talk about it. So what is a public record? It's essentially anything that contains information about the district. Really, it's just anything. I've got a slide here. What is a public record? Prepared, owned, used, or retained by the district, and it relates to district business. If you look at the next slide, what is a writing? And a writing is all kinds of stuff. Pictures, electronic data, cassette tapes, anything you've got that deals with district business is a writing, and therefore a record. And the thing to keep in mind is public records don't need to necessarily be stored at the district. They may be stored elsewhere. So a good example is you do district emails on a personal email account, like your Comcast or Hotmail account. Those emails are still public records because they relate to district business, and they are created, you would say used by the public agency in this case, because you as an elected official are communicating about district business. So those emails are public records. And if a public records request comes in and asks for things that are covered by documents that are in your personal email accounts, you have to go search for those. Which is one of the reasons that we recommend that when you do district business, use a district email account. You have your separate email for your own personal stuff, do we do that here? Do commissioners have a district email account?
Yes.
Perfect. All right. And same thing with the district issued devices. If you use your cell phone, let's say, or a laptop, your personal laptop for district business, and you've got a file stored on your hard drive of your laptop, then that's a public record. And again, if a request comes in, you may have to search that laptop. Whereas I don't know if you have district issued devices. If you do, that's great. You don't have to worry about it. You can just use those exclusively for your district business. There was a case that came up a few years ago now. It was kind of important. It's the Neeson case. I would say about 10, 12 years ago, there was a Shoreline case that came before that. Council member for, yeah.
Oh, you cut out audio for a second.
Oh, I'm
back.
Yeah. But you're back.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. There was a case that came out about 10 years ago or so called Shoreline. It involved the city of Shoreline. One of the council members had public records on her individual computer, her personal computer. And the outcome of that case was that the city had to search the hard drive to find what was metadata in a public record. So these files that you create on your computer, emails, documents, they all have metadata attached to them. And the requester had wanted the metadata. And so the city was required to search the hard drive. Well, then this Neeson case came out more recently and said, that's kind of intrusive. In this day and age, we realize all of you guys are going to be doing work on personal devices from time to time, unless the agency can afford to provide you with district-issued devices. So if that happens, what we're going to require you to do is to sign an affidavit that you did a diligent search, you tried to look for responsive records, and you provided all the responsive records to the agency. So that, it's not as critical anymore if you did use your home computer or your personal laptop, because your ability to comply with the act is kind of, it's a lot easier now in the face of that case. Prior to that, we were pretty concerned about searches. My recommendation is that you see at the bottom of the slide, agencies should create an email retention policy. Why did it do that? Well, in this age of emails, you copy people. And they copy others, and then you hit reply all. How many copies of the same email are in existence? When a public records request comes in, you know, we have to produce these various copies of emails, or at least they come into us for review before we actually produce them. And so an email retention policy can reduce the clutter, so to speak. You only need to keep one copy of every record. What some agencies have done is they say the person that is sending the email has to retain that copy. But if you're a recipient, you're free to delete it. That way there's always some a copy of that record on the district server. You could think about something like that if you wanted to. I don't know if it's a big issue, but we've had some pretty massive requests over the years, and that has, and failing to have such a policy has made responding to a request pretty cumbersome. All right, next slide is public records procedural requirements. So just a few requirements here. You have to have a public records officer. Pam, you're the public records officer, right?
Or no, Nathan is now.
Nathan is, okay. You gotta have a public records officer, and you gotta have procedures describing, you know, kind of how you can request a record from the agency and things of that nature. I'm sure you have something like that posted on your website. Next slide. In terms of providing copies to requesters, so a requester can say, I just want to come in and look at your records. I don't want a copy of them. It's pretty rare that anybody wants to do that anymore. Sometimes requesters say, I want a paper copy. I know you've got electronically, but I want it in paper. You can charge a fee for that. You can adopt a fee schedule. I've got a slide on that. I'm not going to go into that in detail. But 90% or more of the requesters these days just say, send it to me electronically. It's cheap. It's easier for the agency to do that. So that's usually how records are provided. You have to maintain a list of laws that the agency believes that are exempt from disclosure. You simply cite those that are in RCW 4256. And then you have to make records available for inspection and copying during customary business hours, which is at least 30 hours per week, other than holidays. Post those hours on the website so the public knows. But again, most of that, as a practical matter, never comes up because everybody wants records sent to them electronically. If you look at the next slide, it's just a table that shows what you can charge for records. Oftentimes, the charge that you can assess isn't worth your time to actually assess it. You got to pay postage, and the hassle of doing that is oftentimes not worth it. And so my experience is when I make a number of public records requests is that I almost never get charged anything anymore because it's just administratively cumbersome. All right, next slide, requests for public records. So a person that wants a public record can request that in various ways. They can do it verbally. They can send in an email. They can fill out your form. You can write it on a piece of paper that's not your official form. But they have to provide fair notice that they're requesting public records. There have been a few cases that I've been aware of in the past where somebody has made a verbal request to somebody in the agency, a volunteer firefighter, for instance. And then a week or two goes by and they call up the person in the office who's responsible for public records and say, where's my records? I haven't gotten them. There's been no tracking mechanism, no anything. And so your staff needs to be aware of what a public, just to keep their ears open for public records requests, because they unfortunately don't have to be put into writing. The only standard is that they have to give fair notice that they're making a public records request. All right. So that can be a little dangerous. You prefer that a request be in writing, emailed to you, faxed in, or mailed to you, something like that. And I know that Pam, or Nathan, I guess, Nathan, we have a form, do we not, for that we ask people to fill out?
We do, although it tends not to get used, but occasionally.
Some request them by email.
Yeah. All we can do is put the form out there and hope that people use it. It helps us in tracking. It is easier for us to manage these requests when somebody fills out a form, but they're not required to. Give you one example. So years ago, one of my clients got an email out of the blue from RCW4256@hotmail.com, and it had a lengthy public records request. And so before they called me, they wrote back to the individual and said, can you provide us your name and address or name and phone number so we can get in touch with you? And they wrote back and said, no, please provide the records. So then I get a call. What do we do? And I said, well, to me, this looks like a setup because the requester doesn't have to tell you who they are, why they want the records, or anything else. They've given you their identifying information, which is their email address. So under the law, as it stands right now, that is a valid public records request. And you've got to be aware of things like that because, as I said, there are people out there that their business these days is to sue agencies for violating public records requests. All right, so moving on, same slide here. One thing that comes up all the time, and I think we just had it come up here recently, is a request that looks like a public records request, but it's not. It's a request for information. They want questions. They have questions that they want answered. That's not a public records request, and if we choose not to respond to that, we're not going to be in violation of anything. But I usually write back to requesters and say, you know, look, the RCW 4256 is for identifiable public records. It's not an opportunity to ask questions. So, you know, we're not taking this opportunity to respond. Something like that. But you can choose to respond if you wish. It's up to the agency. All right, let's move on to the next slide, district response. So once you get a response in, whether it comes in verbally, through email, or whatever, you have 5 business days to do something. That something is you have to acknowledge the request at a minimum and say, you may have the records easily available, you provide those to the requester. If you don't have them available, you can ask for, or you can say, look, I need this amount of time to search for the records and to provide them to you and give a reasonable estimate of that time. You may have some records posted online. You can just refer the requester to a link. We get requests from time to time that are just not clear. We had this happen last year where a request came in and it was ambiguous. And so you go back to the requester and say, I need you to clarify this. Often, a lot of times a requester gets kind of belligerent and they won't clarify. So what we do then is we say, well, here's what we think your request is. If we're incorrect, let us know. But we're going to act upon this. And sometimes that's the best you can do. And then the final thing you can do is you can deny the request if the records are exempt. And when I say deny, what it means is we notify them that we have public records. They're responsive, but they can't be produced because they fall within an exemption. And I'll talk about that on another slide in a minute. So the next slide here is estimate of time. Any estimates that you provide a requester for, we need more time to get back to you, has to be reasonable. Well, what's reasonable? The answer is and let me give you an example. So I had I represented one of the subcontractors in the tunnel project down in Seattle. And of course, as you might imagine, through all that litigation, public records requests are being made to WSDOT day in and day out. Well, I filed one on behalf of my client, and it took them 18 months to complete that request. Was that reasonable? Well, under the circumstances, it was because WSDOT had other business to do other than responding to public records requests, and they were doing their best. They were taking them in order. But in your case, 18 months to respond to a request is probably not going to be reasonable. So it just the answer is it depends on a variety of factors. For instance, you might need to get clarification from the requester. The records request might kind of implicate third parties that you need to notify and give them an opportunity to go in and seek an injunction. Or it may be complex and just requires to go into our archives and into some dusty boxes and get some old records. It's just going to take some time. So all those factors kind of weigh in on how long it's going to take you. Next slide, estimate of time for further response. One thing to realize is that public records requests are important and you're supposed to provide the fullest assistance to a requester. That's what the statute says, fullest assistance. But it's not to impair your essential agency functions. In other words, you got to keep doing what you're set up to do. and you do the public record stuff as you can. And you can extend the time that you need to respond as long as you need. And it's very common these days for an agency to say, I think I need 30 days, but the 30-day deadline is coming up, and they say, I need another 30 days, something like that. You can do that as long as you've got reasons for it. And the practice tip here, and Nathan knows because we talk to him quite a bit when these requests come in, is just to be in conversation with the requester, let them know what's going on. If you stay in contact with them, you tell them why it's going to take more time. Most people are reasonable. They're understanding of that. It's when you're not communicative that they kind of get ticked off by it and more likely to, file a lawsuit. So, okay, next slide I've got is overbroad requests. There is a statute that says that a request for substantially all public records of an agency is not a valid request for identifiable public records. That's great. That kind of request doesn't come in too often, but there is no kind of overbroad request. In other words, you can't just respond to a request. You're requesting too many records here. As long as they're requesting identifiable public records, it's a valid request, no matter how extensive it may be. And so what you see sometimes is a request that just says, I want all records that have this keyword. They'll list out maybe a dozen keywords or a topic. And that is a valid request, and you do have to search for those. So oftentimes you might have to get your IT folks involved and go through your electronic files and find those records that have that keyword located within them. You can deny a bot request. The statute allows you to do that. A bot request is one that you reasonably believe to be generated by a computer program or a script. Okay. Searches for responsive records, always recommend that before we start looking for anything, we just figure out where those records are going to be. We're required as an agency to do a reasonable search. And so a reasonable search means we kind of consider where those records are going to be found, what formats they're going to be in, who may have them, and then we start going out to those locations and trying to collect those records. At the end of the day, it has to be reasonably calculated to uncover responsive records. If it's not, then you can't hide behind the fact that, well, I asked two of the commissioners for records, and I got all of theirs, and I thought that's where they would, where responsive records would be. Turns out one of the other commissioners has another record that's responsive. Maybe that request was not reasonably Maybe our search was not reasonably calculated to uncover all of them, and we could be held liable for that. So we bear the burden of proof. And Nathan does an excellent job. He's very comprehensive, and I know he goes through these kinds of analyses at the beginning to find out where records are going to be, and that is key in this day and age to avoiding lawsuits. So there are certain software programs, the feature of tracking requests and records, there's software out there that some agencies are buying, it's not cheap, that allow, some agencies that get a ton of these requests in, it's gotten to the point where they've hired staff that all they do is public records requests. So they bought software to kind of track the requests and to make it easy to provide responsive documents to requesters and that kind of thing. I don't think your agency's at that point yet, but I just have a slide to kind of show you that's where this stuff is going. Next slide, exemptions. So most documents have to be produced. If you're going to hold on to a document, it has to fall directly within an exemption listed in the statute. And you have to tell the requester why you're holding on to it. Give them enough information for them to be able to evaluate whether that exemption is legitimate or not. So you provide the date, the type of record, who authored it, who received it, total number of pages that you're withholding, and kind of a brief explanation of why it is that the record falls within an exemption. Some common exemptions are a record that's covered by attorney-client privilege, For your purposes, we sometimes get requests that involve protected health information. If we can redact that health information, we do so when we produce the balance of the record. Pending investigation records, that doesn't usually come up in case of San Juan EMS. Personnel files, some parts of the personnel files are public records, other parts are not. It's kind of complicated and you have to just kind of go through that. I'm not going to go into the detail on it here, but that is an area that is rife with litigation right now. Most recently, the Supreme Court held that dates of birth of public employees are legitimate records that can be requested, which came as a surprise, I think, to virtually all practitioners in this area. There is no standalone privacy exemption. There's nothing in the statute that says that if you think a record is going to invade somebody's privacy, that you can hold on to it. The privacy has to be attached to an express exemption in the statute. So this is a law that, again, contemplates that almost everything is a public record with limited exceptions. You go to the next page, again, we talked a bit about this, enforcement and penalties. $100 a day per record is the maximum, and that can go up, it can go down based upon mitigating factors. The plaintiff doesn't have to prove any damages, they don't have to prove that they were harmed in any way, they just have to prove violation. And if they're successful, they get attorney's fees and costs. Unfortunately, for an agency, you don't get your attorney's fees and costs if you win the lawsuit. It just goes one way. So if you go to the next slide, penalty factors, courts sometimes will mitigate the penalty if there are various mitigating factors that are present, such as the request wasn't very clear. You did your best, the request was just kind of a crummy request, and you didn't understand it, and you were reasonable in your lack of understanding. Let's say that you promptly followed up, you maintained good communication with the requester, that's a mitigating factor. Proper training and supervision, reasonableness of your search, all those kinds of factors help to mitigate any penalty that might be imposed. Go to the next slide and you see some things, and this is just a small smattering of things that can increase your penalty. Like delayed response, you wait more than 5 days to respond initially, or you say that you need 20 days to respond, you actually don't get in touch with the requester until the 30th day and provide the documents. That's not a good thing. That's a violation of the act. You don't supervise your agency's personnel or have them properly trained, those people that are involved in the searches. Or you're just negligent, you act in bad faith, or intentionally non-compliant. All of those things can cause the court to increase the penalty. Next slide, public records officer. You've designated Nathan as the public records officer. He's the liaison between the agency and the public, the members of the public that make these requests. He's responsible for overseeing compliance with the law. And his name should be posted somewhere on the district's website so the public knows who your public records officer is. In the next slide, there's new reporting requirements for Public Records Act purposes, and all agencies have to log certain information now and provide that to the state. Whether this amounts to, in the future, any changes to the Public Records Act or not remains to be seen. There have been efforts from time to time to kind of reduce the burden on public agencies of this act, but nobody in the legislature's had the fortitude to really tackle that. So until something dramatic changes, I don't see any major changes coming down the pike on this law. So just a smattering of recent decisions involving the Public Records Act that are kind of interesting. As I mentioned before, an employee's full name and date of birth are not exempt. That was just decided back in October. Pretty surprising decision. The Gibson versus Snohomish County case said that exemptions, if a document is exempt at the time the request is made, that's the only thing you need to worry about. There's no requirement later. That document later loses its exemption. You don't have to go back to the requester and say, oh, now we've got this document that the exemption is gone. I'll give an example of that. One of the exemptions is, and I failed to mention this, it's called the deliberative process exemption. This is where the chief or the superintendent sends the commission a memo and says, here's what I think. These are my opinions, my suggestions. That's a part of the deliberative process of the agency. And until the commission actually makes a decision, that record is exempt and doesn't need to be provided. So let's say you got a records request for that very memo. You could exempt it. And you tell the requester, I'm not going to provide it. A month goes by, the commission makes the decision. You're not required to go back to the requester and say, hey, here's the document now. The decision's been made and this record is no longer exempt. That's what that case was about. Next case, Service Employees International said that not all records on an agency server are public records just because they're on the agency server. This related to kind of an organizing effort by employees to be part of the union. Court said that the record that's on the server must relate to the conduct of government to actually be a public record. There's a Freedom Foundation case recently decided, so state law does not establish the factors to consider in determining a reasonable time for providing records. We talked about that before. Those factors can be very variable depending on a variety of factors. You can delay the production of records to determine whether to seek an injunction against the records release. So sometimes it happens that we get a request that affects a third party. We don't think that it's exempt, but we'll tell that third party, hey, we got this request in. If you want to go to court and try and preclude its release, go for it. And then it's up to that third party to try and keep the record from becoming, from being produced. All right, next slide. Just kind of my observation on the Public Records Act. As much as it is kind of a burden to agencies and has gotten to the point where it's a real liability risk, think of this law as to what the district does as opposed to kind of an interference with your daily business. It's important. It's important for purposes of transparency. Even though it's time consuming and, you know, part of Nathan's time is spent dealing with public records requests, this really gives you an opportunity to provide great customer service. You can really, and we'll talk about the political bank account that district has in the next part of the presentation today. This is one way to really build up your political bank account. When requesters see that you know what you're doing, you've got a good system in place, you're responsive, you get your you answer the records requests in a timely fashion. Next thing is just build in, and you may do this already, build into your budget a cost for responding to these requests. That includes, you know, some component for consulting with the attorney, some component for, you know, Nathan's time, and so forth. There are costs associated with that, and that's just something that agencies these days are just routinely budgeting for. If you do a good job with this, you really do create a culture of openness, and you build trust with the community. So it's great that you're going through this training. The fact that you're going through the training in an open meeting like this is just further evidence of that. So kind of in summary, practice tips. This is a...
I think we have a question. Sorry, let's interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, I have a question before we get off of this. If I keep a daytime planner with all my meetings and all that kind of stuff in there, is that subject to a public records request? And it doesn't make a difference if I buy the planner or the district buys the planner.
Yeah, it probably is a public records request because it does relate to the conduct of government, and the question is it owned, used, or retained by a public agency? Well, you're an employee of the hospital district. Even though you bought the paper on which you're writing those notes, I think it probably qualifies for that reason. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So just again, practice tip here. Use your district email account, try to avoid personal accounts, and try and avoid personal devices when possible. It sounds like you're able to do that. You're able to provide personal devices. Think about an email retention policy. Oh, one thing I didn't mention is when we don't have too many, you know, really extensive public records requests, but when we do, you can make a requester happier by producing those records in installments rather than waiting months and months to get all the records together and then dumping them on them at once. And that's what agencies tend to do. So like with the WSDOT request that I mentioned, during that 18-month period, I'm getting like every couple of months, an email shows up in my email box, big pile of records. Another few months goes by and I get another pile. And it was like I knew that they were working on it and it was great to get installments as those records became available. The last thing is deliberative process. I just mentioned the memo that the chief might write to the commission. If you've got a memo that is or a document that is going to be subject to the deliberative process, it helps everybody. It helps Nathan if that were marked in such a way, have a stamp or some indication on the record that it's subject to deliberative process. I'll give you an example. One of the port districts we represent, the executive director sends out a weekly summary to the commission. And he says in that, at the beginning, this constitutes my own opinions and recommendations and is subject to the deliberative process exemption. So if we ever got a request for that, the person who's looking at that to see if it's exempt would say, this is exempt. And so it's just kind of a handy tool for that purpose. Next slide. Think about former employees who may take records with them. It's probably not an issue for you since it sounds like most of the work is done on district devices, but for an agency where some work might have been done on a person's personal laptop and those records were not transferred to the server. This is always an issue when somebody leaves the agency. You've got to make sure you preserve any records that might be on their personal devices. I've talked about that last part. So we're kind of done with open government.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, Nathan.
So the deliberative process exemption does expire once the decision is made, correct? But you can destroy those records if you wish. They're not something you have to retain.
What, the deliberative process record?
So the deliberative process, that exemption does expire once the decision is made.
Correct.
But when you're speaking about retention of records, you can destroy those records, correct?
Well, but you have a retention policy, and so you're not going to be able to destroy that right away. You probably have a fairly lengthy retention policy on that record, 7 years or something.
But, I mean, drafts under the retention schedule are transitory records.
That's not a draft, though. That would have been a memo to the commission saying, here are my thoughts. I've been, you know, it might be, let's say that it's on fire and EMS integration. Uh-huh. You know, and he sends a memo to the commission saying, here are my thoughts on this and the status of things, and here's what I recommend going forward. That's a document that is, and that remains exempt until the commission makes the decision. But if you entered into an ILA on that issue, the decision's been made, that document is no longer exempt, but you can't destroy it, at least not until the retention period has run out. That wasn't a draft. That was a memo that went to the commission.
Okay.
Anything else? Any other questions on public records?
Boy, that's a tricky subject.
I have a question because I'm still not clear about
people's we don't destroy
intent,
anything really.
You know, their intentions of requesting public records. Like, can you give me an example that might relate to a hospital district?
Nathan, what are some of the requests we've gotten recently? You remember this stuff better than I do.
Yeah, you know, and I keep a lot of detailed records of these. You guys are all welcome to come by and see the kinds of requests we look and how we respond and that sort of thing. The most recent request we got is actually a pretty good example of an unclear request. They sent us an email, and it just said, I heard you completed, you know, had a recent audit. I'd like a copy. Well, what does recent mean? I mean, there's all these audits going back for years. I had no idea what he really wanted. And so we did pretty much exactly what Richard was talking about. I just downloaded the last three or four audits, sent them off to him and said, I don't really know what you want, but here's the last few audits, and you know, if it's not what you're looking for, let me know. And it turned out we had given the document he wanted. Other kinds of requests that we get are often like commissioner emails on different subjects. Communication between Commissioner X and Commissioner Y on such and such subject. You know, emails are a common thing that gets requested. You should pretty much treat any email you send as something someone will read at some point. And we don't really cull emails at all. You know, we'll destroy other records, but we tend not to destroy emails because it's hard. To access your email accounts, we've got to go through our IT services. So anyway, it's getting off track a little bit, but the point is we get a variety of requests, and when we closed the medical center, we got almost 300 boxes of documents. And so, you know, there were lots of financials. There were ancient patient records from way back when, you know, that had this forever long retention schedule on them. And some of those we had to keep because they still haven't met their expiration date, you know, when you can destroy them. So, yeah.
It seems to me that we receive more public records requests when the board is operating in a way that doesn't seem transparent to the public. That's something that we as a board can avoid, I think, the public records requests by operating in a way that is transparent.
I think that's a good point.
Yeah.
I do think that the public, when they get suspicious that the commission is acting in secret, there's a greater propensity to, I'm going to file requests and see what's going on back there. Mm-hmm. The second point Nathan made, it was a good point, is anything you don't want to see in the paper, don't put it in an email. Because you can expect that what you put in an email can be requested at one point or another. So don't say anything in an email that you don't want publicized. We can't actually ask somebody why they're making a public records request. We don't know what their intent is all the time. Sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes it's just personal in nature. We had one not too long ago where I think they wanted the records because of some litigation they were involved in personally. It was going to help them. They needed the information. Sometimes it's just that they're curious about what's going on. So it's all over the map.
Before we move on to the next section, should we take a 5-minute break?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Great, thanks.